that kind of, you know, I'm not sure where it fits, but that makes me think of the thing you forwarded me on LinkedIn the other day. As we think about that cluster model for talent, what's going to attract talent? We talk about quality of life. We talk about the ability of cities to kind of deliver. We talk about tourism, and especially tourism cities. Yes. And you sent me a thing where I think somebody had said that, and I think I wrote it down here, that today's traveler is tomorrow's talent. So those places that are clustering tourist talent in their tourist mode.
Right.
How do you capitalize on that? I remember when I worked for Miami Beach, we'd have big conventions. We'd target them at the golf course when they were doing their convention golf tournament, and to try and expose the opportunities that we had in Miami Beach as we had these decision makers more on the corporate side coming.
Yeah, we used to do that for businesses, right?
Right. Now,
but now we actually have to do it for talent. And how do we, you know, what are the strategies around? I think it's a great idea.
You know, how do you recruit talent at Disney World?
Oh God, just freaking shoot me.
No, I know, but
I know it's true.
It doesn't have to be at Disney World, but it can be when families are on vacation to Disney. You know, I know, and I, you know, I don't go to Disney World, but I know plenty of people in Miami who have annual memberships for their families and are making that. And again, you can live anywhere in Florida, and if you want Disney, if
that's part of what you like. Yeah.
You can do that for your family. So as part of your decision, but how do you reach those people? Is you're not going to reach them advertising to them at their workplace. You're going to reach them when they're in a place they enjoy being.
They're having a great time. Yeah. And you know what? You could be doing this all the time. Actually, I have this conversation with my youngest sister. She loves Florida. She loves being on the beach, but she's sitting in a law firm as the executive assistant to the managing partner in Cincinnati and can't quite make the move. But I'm like, you could be going to the beach every weekend and maybe twice during the week. What are you still doing in Cincinnati?
You know, somebody said the other day, not too long ago, and I know Mayor Gelber repeated it, but I don't remember where I first heard it, but someone pointed out, you know, again, it's a Miami Beach thing, but that's something we know, that, you know, reminding people that we live in a place that the rest of the world works 51 weeks a year to spend 1 week where we live. And there is a selling point.
Sure.
For that.
No question.
Well, it's funny because here in Chattanooga, obviously, we recruit for folks that like hiking and rock climbing and the mountains. And so, you know, when you're hiking, you run into somebody, it's like, hey, where are you from? Well, I'm from Colorado. No surprises there. You know, and so we do have folks from Colorado and Utah and, you know, Northern California who end up here for the hiking. And the rock climbing, and, you know, lo and behold, they end up coming here, moving here.
So, you know, some places like a Miami Beach have a very distinct urban environment, right? And so that becomes a distinguisher when you're trying to attract talent. But places like, I mean, and other places like a Chattanooga or Cincinnati, like to think they have a distinct urban place that is a real distinguisher for them when it comes to talent. It's probably more of a, you met my baseline for urban experiences and fun, but yes. It's not a distinguisher because it's just not unique enough or strong enough. It's not a New York, it's not a South Beach.
I agree.
Right? But clearly for at least a decade, if not longer, the outdoor environment, active outdoor environment distinguisher has absolutely been proven to be true. So whether it's Idaho or Montana or Chattanooga or the Carolinas, or even I think, you know, we've kind of hit on this in Martin County, right? Yeah. That ability to get outdoors has been particularly essential for attracting and retaining young talent. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that is one of those really interesting distinguishers. And I think, you know, helping our communities understand what is truly distinctive, what gives them a competitive advantage and what doesn't is part of what we have to do. But some of them don't, it's so innate to them. Like, it's, of course we have mountains. So what's a big deal, right?
Right.
Of course we have great waterways and boating opportunities. So what's a big deal, right? It's just here. It's just part of who we are, but they don't think of it as an advantage or one of those, you know, kind of assets that they have that is unique. It gives them, that distinguishes them. It gives them a competitive advantage. And I think that's going to be a new awakening for a lot of our communities, trying to figure out what those outdoor things are versus their, you know, what's really a distinguisher for them versus other places. And in Martin County, it's like, if you want to be in Southeast Florida or in South Florida for the most part and have kind of this really, I'll call it a back to nature, more environmental engagement experience. Yeah. I'm going to point you to Martin County.
Absolutely.
Now that I know more about it. Right. Yeah. And there is a clear portion, and probably I would say even a significant portion of young talent that is looking for that kind of environment, a la Chattanooga, North Carolina, Colorado, Idaho. Used to be California. California is just so goofy. I'm not sure if it, yeah, you know what? California still has it. California is one of the few places that has beach and mountain, and it's one of their key advantages, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, those are important things for us to talk about as part of economic development strategy.
Yeah, and I think that on the outdoor, you know, all of those pieces, and then I think for some areas like South Florida and maybe Southern California,
mm-hmm.
and maybe parts of Texas and other places is not just for talent, but when we talk about talent, maybe the entrepreneurship side for those that can, the year-round opportunities with the outdoor.
Yeah.
So if you think about the cafe owners in New York who can only operate outside but can't operate outside right now.
Right.
You know, that does not provide the customer experience that people want.
Yeah. Right. If you have the ability, if that is something that's important to your business and you have the ability to relocate that business, it becomes an opportunity for communities on sort of that business attraction, entrepreneur attraction, where you can provide that.
Right. Well, and I know we didn't touch it, but I think the other piece when it comes to sort of attracting talent is the trailing spouse. It's sort of, you know, if you're moving to an area and you have a position that offers remote working, okay, well, that's great, but how about your spouse? What industry are they in? And how does that work? And how does it work in sort of a secondary or tertiary city?
Right.
Because we do a great job recruiting sort of top talent, and then you've got to figure out, or they have to figure out, okay, well, I also have a spouse who needs a job. So tell me about the other opportunities in the city.
Yeah. I mean, remote is clearly a great advantage for that right now.
Mm-hmm.
But what occurs to me is those smaller communities have an opportunity to create relationships with larger communities to kind of attack that.
Mm.
Right. So if I'm in, I don't know, if I'm in Chattanooga and I have a relationship with a variety of companies, either in California or the Northeast or whatever, that are looking for remote talent, and I've got a trailing spouse, I'm going to help them with their talent needs. And, I know how to help them I know how to help that trailing spouse find a great remote opportunity. Am I well positioned to do that? Or is it just kind of like, oh yeah, you should go look in New York, right?
This just happened in Rockledge. They brought in a new redevelopment manager.
Yeah.
And he came in and was getting up to speed and getting on. And it was about 4 months, found out that he had left. And so I emailed him or texted him and asked. And as we dug into it, you know, they had relocated from, I can't remember, from somewhere. So but there was a job for his wife. And then during the pandemic, that job disappeared. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't able to stay. They went back to where it was that they had come from. And for that exact reason, that's something that's dealt with a lot in the military.
Hmm. In universities, interestingly enough.
How interesting. Do they have systems or processes or people assigned to help with that?
They do. It sort of, and I couldn't really speak to now, but I remember when I was in, it was kind of scattered. It kind of depended on the base that you were going to. And the support system that you had for spouses varied from base to base.
Yeah.
And I remember it because I remember when I was stationed in Panama, and we always, you hear these things and you don't know how valid they are, but I think I've since seen kind of it documented that it was true. You know, in the case of Panama, you had the Panama Canal Treaty, which my understanding is it called for up to 90% of the on-base jobs to be for Panamanians.
Oh, wow.
And so when people would arrive to base and then have their dependents or their spouses with them who may have been used to employment on base, mm-hmm. those opportunities didn't exist on that duty assignment. That's where I first became aware of the issue with military spouses with their employment was that down there they weren't able to get employment when they were on those assignments.
But I actually think this is a really good question you've asked, Sharita. And you know, I would argue that most places don't have a support network for that. No, most communities don't even address it.
Right.
And again, as we get into this really fierce competition for talent, I think helping our clients set something like that up could give them a pretty distinct advantage.
I think so. I really think so.
I mean, in universities, when they're recruiting senior staff, if they're recruiting them from out of town, there's almost always a negotiation about the trailing spouse and at least a temporary assignment somehow, either with the university or a partner organization, right. That helps with that transition. But I think more and more mid-sized companies are going to have to get better at this. And mid-sized and smaller companies are going to have to get better at this.
Right.
To compete for talent. And they're not going to have the capacity to do it internally. They're just not big enough. So as an economic development tool, how do you create that kind of in the community versus inside the company?
Remember the old school welcome wagon?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think what you just mentioned, Ken, probably is the military is a place to probably look, because I think it is more in the community of other spouses that a lot of that happens.
Yeah. Okay.
And then maybe connecting with some more official efforts. I'm not real sure, but you know, obviously there's places we could acquire.
Well, and you know, again, part of this is there's a quality of life question, right, that we know about. But when you have a trailing spouse, they want the answer to the question before somebody says yes.
Yes.
Right? And how do you make that happen for a mid-sized company or a small company in a mid-sized community? You know, if you're going to New York or you're going to Silicon Valley or even Miami, there's yeah. so much going on. You can roll the dice a little bit, right? But in smaller communities, it's not so obvious. And so the principal recruit is going to want to know the answer to the question before they say yes, he or she.
Right.
Well, and it's funny because we've seen it. I've seen it with hospital administrators being recruited, superintendents being recruited, political appointments and administrations. Again, it's just sort of, you know, what's the system and who manages and navigates that? Is it through the chamber?
And part of it is that we've kind of always done this at an executive level.
Yes.
And it's been necessary because you know, executive talent is always kind of in short demand, frankly. I mean, really good, great executive talent, right? But now we've got that at multiple levels, if not all levels. So how do you begin to apply those same principles to that even frontline manager, mm-hmm. right? Or at least a department head, which would you've never had that conversation with a department head before. But if you want a good department head, you're going to have that conversation now.
So how do you get a city ready? How do you get a municipality ready for those conversations? Like, where in the workforce ecosystem do you park that?
Yeah, because it's going to have to be quick response kind of thing. I mean, mm-hmm. it for me, it feels like a chamber assignment. I just worry about how good they'll actually be at it.
It does give, you know, it's always interesting to see, you know, every community is different in the role that its chamber plays in economic development. Mm-hmm. And some play a bigger role and some don't play a role at all. And but it seems like a very good role for a chamber to play when it comes to their economic development.
It's a very specific kind of talent that you need to be able to quickly take care of that. And it's obviously highly confidential and all that stuff. I don't know. I think it's a really, maybe is there a business opportunity for this? Is there a business opportunity for us in this?
I don't know. I'm thinking this through. Because there's definitely a need. And talent is going to be moving.
Talent is going to be the commodity.
Absolutely, without a doubt.
It is the key ingredient. It is the secret ingredient to success from here, at least for another 100 years.
Well, and it's funny because I do feel like these conversations happen around elementary and secondary school admissions. I do feel like when an executive's moving to town and they have school-age children, I do feel like there is a network or a system. And I saw it when I was in Miami and I've seen it in Chattanooga where it's like, I've got 3 kids, got to get them into school. And there's always someone that sort of facilitates those conversations. And those are held before the person makes the sort of acceptance decision. Right.
And sometimes that's a realtor, truthfully. But it just depends on, you know, again, the level of the executives.
Yeah.
You know, it's somebody gets that assignment and, you know, they get handholding, right?
Yeah.
But we've not done that further down the organizational chart before. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, it certainly creates a distinct advantage. That's what I like about it.
Because I think we recruited a business and the future plant manager, that project's still under construction, potential plant manager from Ohio actually came down and said he would be relocating his family. His wife was not able to find a position, and so he declined it. He's still with the company. He's just not coming down to manage his facility. And so someone else came in.
Yeah, and this is really interesting because as we talk about, you know, how important quality of life is now for these talent decisions and the location they're going to go, happy wife, happy life.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're selling to more than one person. Yeah,
say that jokingly, we may be recruiting a woman and the man is the trailing spouse, but it is. I mean, this is a core quality of life decision determinant in they're making that decision. I mean, I just think back to my parents moving, you know, when my dad left West Texas State to go to Louisiana Tech, you know, for a couple of native Texans that, you know, and, you know, just kind of thinking
crossing
about
that line.
Yeah. you know, and it's a big decision that has a big impact on your happiness.
With the economic developer?
I don't know if we're going to solve this today, but I think we need to revisit it. My wheels are spinning like a million miles an hour on this one, Sharita. It's a great idea.
So, Sharita, the one place that I would say, and you said economic developer, and I was going to say that it could be the economic developer in those places where the skill sets change and they do recognize the importance of talent, mm-hmm. and it becomes one of the primary sort of skills and focus areas of that economic developer, then this seems like it might be something that fits in there. But it's going to be, you know, if that economic developer, this is part of their sort of set of skills.
I think what I'm struggling with is, you know, this function that we're talking about has to be nimble and fast and very, very customer service oriented mm-hmm. to make the sale. And chambers and governments and institutions don't fit that category for me 99% of the time.
I mean, if you have an EDC rather than your chamber.
Yeah, an EDC is, you know what, that's probably a much better fit, but it could just simply be, you know, a group of these organizations providing support for a whole new kind of nonprofit. It's really focused on this.
Right.
Now, of course, the chamber and the EDC will want, you know, they'll want the game. So maybe you can't get that done. But, you know, it's just, this is like headhunter down the chain, and the headhunter doing the legwork it requires to do the trailing spouse sale.
Right.
It's highly, kind of highly specialized and fairly sophisticated work.
Right.
Right. It's not easy stuff.
Right.
So the function I am like 110% behind. The structure and the org chart and, you know, who's actually going to pull it off, I'm still really confused about. I could see the nightmare that this would create in, you know, almost every chamber of commerce that I've dealt with. And the EDCs aren't always a whole lot better because most of them are still chasing companies.
Right. But again, I mean, it factors into retention.
Yeah. It's the right idea. I just organizationally, you know, which of the players in the economic development world is going to pivot to do this? I don't know.
You know, well, and I think that to a certain extent, as you said, with if you have air company or EDCs or organizations that are still chasing the companies, you're going to have some who, you know, it's those who do make the adjustment to the talent side that are going to be the first ones that are going to get this. So if an EDC or an economic development department or whoever it is has not adapted to focusing on talent rather than companies, forget about the trailing spouse. That's not even going to be part of it. So it's really going to be those companies again. It's another aspect of the adaptability within economic development within our field. And who's going to be Wintersville and who's going to be Losersville on some of these issues and how well you adapt or die.
Because that would be an interesting sort of marketing or promotional. I mean, seriously, to say as part of your recruitment strategy, you also have a trailing spouse.
And again, if you're offering that as a kind of a community-wide service versus at an individual company, that's a really fascinating distinguisher.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, we're not going to solve it today. And we were positive about planners.
Oh, well, then we need to have another podcast to fix that. But yeah.
I know, Cam. recovering yeah. planner?
Yeah. Well, it's not recovering. It's what's the term?
Oh, I call former, it. I call
former former. Planner. Yeah. And I made a presentation of a bunch of planners last week in St. Louis. That was fun.
Yeah.
I had to pull out my, you know, I'm a planner too card.
Yeah, yeah.
As I was talking to them about safety and the fact that they hadn't done shit about safety. But.
And I think that, you know, for the future, you know, as we start thinking about how you do some of these things, you know, and it's one of the things that I'd written down, it's not so much an emerging trend, but maybe it should be though, is, you know, just the thought of some common sense guys, you know, just like we were talking about just sort of the customer service and the empathy and just being human, you know, a lot of what we do doesn't have to really be that hard. You know, to be successful for a community, but to be successful in economic development. Not that we're going to pull the curtain all the way back.
That's what I'm saying.
Adjusting the bus schedule so the employees can get there on time. Yeah, not rocket science, right?
Yeah.
No, I agree.
It's
like an economic developer to ask the question. Like, it's right. not that hard.
No, exactly. But I think one of the things that shows is I think there's part of this not being that hard is having that economic developer and having someone that understands all these different perspectives. Because it might not be that, but it's also understanding that the structural plans reviewer has this perspective that he's probably not thinking outside of.
Right.
It's probably, you know, may not, you never know what his family background is, may have never really been around entrepreneurs or small business owners or so it's remembering that they have that and remembering that the business owner or the architect who's banging on the door or sending nasty emails, he doesn't have the perspective of, you know, the plans examiner who's, you know, got two vacancies in his department.
Right.
And is sitting there overloaded. And so I do think that part of our field and part of our job in economic development is to understand those perspectives because they also don't speak the same language. We're almost these translators that kind of keep them out of trouble with each other. Or
a lot of what we do is translating.
Yeah,
no question. Yeah.
And so I'm sure that
we're talking about planners again.
We're talking about planners again.
No, actually, I think we're talking about. And this really, the light bulb went on for me in my university work about this, that, you know, the worlds are so different between business and government, that it requires translation. It requires, hang on, you're not really understanding this. This is what they're really talking about because you can look at it from both sides and very few people do. Right. So those of us who have worked inside government and been out in the economic development world on the business side or who have our own businesses or whatever else it is, we have that ability to bridge it or translate it or however you want to, whatever you want to call it, because we can understand what people are trying to accomplish from their perspective and their world, understand what they're getting measured by. This was my aha moment in universities. And then find solutions that kind of can get everybody what they want. Mm-hmm. If you don't know both perspectives or all perspectives, it's very difficult to do.
And that's what always bothered me. I think, you know, one of the things we talk about with our approach is the economic development values, and they're not for the economic developer. They're for everyone else that sort of touches the economic development process. And it's these perspectives. And you know, you hear politicians that will run and they talk about, and spread, you hear this a lot at the local level, you know, about getting in and being business friendly and running government like a business. And I never really liked that because government's not a business and it doesn't have the same motivations. It does not have the same goals and perspectives. But what I took from that you should do, that it comes down to, is what government can do is they can adopt private sector standards for customer service and responsiveness.
Yeah, that's great.
Because that is not part of the regulatory process. You know, you see regulators sometimes hide behind the codes and you know, it's my license under state statute. I'm, you know, well, the Florida building code doesn't say anything about waiting 5 days before you call someone back. You know,
Well, it should.
And so to me, that's really where you can make a difference on more just in that responsiveness and understanding those perspectives about, you know, from the private sector, the risk that's, you know, the capital that's out there and the time value of money and those things, I think is.
I mean, and just understanding the motivations around the table, right? And so, you know, part of what I help people understand about universities is you understand the number one criteria for a university president or chancellor, right? Their number one metric. Everybody understands that, right? People say, yeah, it's enrollment. No, it's research dollars. I was like, wrong. Fundraising.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you don't know, you know, what those different motivations are in place, you know, if it's a project manager on the private side, it's a schedule. Right.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to hurt that person, then you know how to hurt them, which a lot of planners do, by the way, intentionally. Yeah. They delay things. But if you want to work with them, then you need to understand that that's a priority for them. Right. And that time is money to them very, very seriously. And so figure out how to help them with that. And they will get much easier to deal with on the things that are important, including safety and your license. Right.
Right.
It's an interesting challenge. I mean, but you know, this is why they pay us the big bucks.
Yes,
because we can fix these problems. Right.
Cool.
That's what they say. Well, I think that's a pretty good. I think maybe transition out of this one.
Yeah,
we have plenty to come up. I think a couple of things we even talked about, you know, the cluster model. I'm sure we'll have plenty more of these about talent.
Yeah.
As it goes.
And multiple nuances and different aspects of it. I agree.
Yeah.
And the other piece, I'd love to have a podcast on the Great Resignation. Like, where are these people going? Like, what businesses are they starting? Are they licensed businesses? Are they, like, what are people doing? Are they just living off their savings? Have they decided to live differently now? Do they gave up a six-figure job? Have they decided, well, you know what? I only need $48,000 a year to live on. Like, what do they do?
Back in with their parents.
Yeah. And I think that's something we can look at, you know, and we can use some of the tools, some of the data, and some of the new, more current technological systems that we subscribe to and that we have to kind of pose some of these questions, maybe bring Farrell in and start kind of get an understanding on that, on what those trends look like.
That actually is a pretty good idea. If we can be out in front on some of that research and understanding kind of what I'll call the talent trends.
Yeah.
So, you know, all, you know, Esri and Placer, they're giving us real estate and even activity kinds of trends, but
then we have MC with all of the talent and workforce.
Yeah, but okay, so maybe it can help us answer this question.
So,
but you know, some of this is macro.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I am not a great researcher. So,
well, I think it's
I like the question.
And then I think it's connecting some of these. It's you know, the MC is going to be very data heavy.
Yeah.
And Esri, you know, the Placer is data, but your start, it's the data side of behavior. So kind of starting to connect these different systems together with our insights starts getting us into behavior and where they're going and some of those things, and maybe identifying some of the things you're not going to get from a more traditional something like workforce data with MC. And then maybe it may come up with some additional questions that then we have to go out to either non-traditional sources, or they're more qualitative, not quantitative.
Right.
Things that we need to then go look at.
But, you know, I would say that there's probably enough research about these questions that have been done so far that if Farrell were to take a look at that research and understand the data sources they're using, that there might be an opportunity for us to do something similar on a regional basis. Because a lot of this is very macro, right? It's national, right. It's global. But if you start to look at what it means for different regions, I haven't seen anything on that yet.
I haven't either.
Not really, right? And so has the Great Resignation come with a great migration? I don't know. What's the answer to that question? And if so, who are the winners and who are the losers?
And so we are looking at some new migration data.
Okay.
We're still kind of getting up to speed on it and understand it. We're looking at it. We actually just ran it for North Miami.
Okay.
So we're trying to, we're going to be doing a little more kind of educating ourselves on really how to get down in and understand what it's telling us. But it's showing us both regional and sort of the broader migration trends in and out of the city over, I think we pulled the data back to 2018.
Okay.
Cool. So what are you guys doing fun after this?
I have no idea.
So thank you for joining this little 5-part series with Ken and Sharina. I thank them so much for giving us their perspectives. We're going to kick off season 2 just coming right up in our next episode. And we're really going to transition into economic development perspectives. And those perspectives when it comes to community character and the creatives. We'll talk a little bit about music as economic development and really the importance of lifestyle choices and how people think and feel about a place and how that is one of the key things that drives economic development, economic growth, and quality of life enhancements. Thank you for tuning into Flareheads. This podcast is dedicated to the entrepreneurs and the small business owners who toil every day to build and grow their dream, and also to those public officials that understand the perspective of those dreamers and who actively support them, understanding the positive impact they have on their community's quality of life. The Flareheads podcast is hosted and executive produced by myself, Kevin Crowder, alongside executive producer and senior editor, Julian Duque, and it is a production of the Business Flare Publishing Group. Please connect with us on all social media. You will find us there as Business Flare, and you can download our ebook, Governing for Economic Development, from Amazon in English and Spanish. The theme song is Surf Rat, an original composition performed by Miami's heavy metal band McFisty and written by Kevin Crowder and the rest of the band. And a special thanks goes out to our tribe of Flareheads, our team, our clients, our friends, our partners, our family, and the rest of Flarehead Nation for your support and inspiration. Please join us again. Thank you.